Now to the subject area that we explored together when I was here a couple of weeks ago on the subject of karma. And at the time, I was focusing comments mostly on the relationship between karma and compassion. And this evening, I want to complement that with some comments, then of course making sure we have time for some discussion on the subject of karma and responsibility. Karma and personal responsibility, and karma and social responsibility. So first, once again, the term itself. The complete Sanskrit term is actually karma vipaka. And what that means is action and result, or action and fruition. Okay. So when you hear that term karma, there are different ways to understand that word and its meanings. Okay. It's used as a noun, and there were theories of karma that were abounded during the time of the Buddha, actually. There were theories that said everything that happens to you in your life is the result of past karma, including and perhaps particularly the caste into which you were born. And if you want to have a more favorable rebirth next time around, then you should dutifully fulfill all the responsibilities of whatever caste you're in this time around, because everything is fated, everything is interconnected. That was not the Buddha's view, and so we'll get into that a little bit more later on. There are also, within the Buddha Dharmas, different ideas about the teaching of karma and what that means. Okay. I don't really, even though, you know, my day job as a scholar, I'm not so interested in going there, you know. What I'm much more interested in is the way the Buddha spoke about the term, okay, which might be better understood, and I'm going to instead use the term karmic process. The means by which past karma has been generated, and the means by which our tendencies, our habituated tendencies in the generation of that karma might be modified or liberated so that we generate different kind of karma in the future. The entire cycle, the process by which that occurs. Sometimes referred to as the law of cause and effect. Too linear, I think, because it's not just only about your actions, things you did in the past or things done to you or things you may or may not do in the future that are determinative here, but rather the interaction of karmic cause and effect across the entire field. Okay, so instead of thinking just about, you know, our own actions and their consequences, Gils Fronsdale, a teacher who thinks about and talks about and writes about this topic a fair amount, said, imagine instead, you know, when we talk about the linearity or cause and effect just on so far as your own thoughts and deeds and words are concerned, like dropping a pebble in a pond. He said, what's instead really going on, it's like throwing an entire fistful of pebbles in a pond, right? And you're just one of the pebbles. And your actions have consequences that affect others. Others' actions affect you. So he talks about a karmic sea of cause and effect, that we're all literally in this together, and that our states of mind and our words and our deeds are constantly influencing each other. So one of the ways in which the Buddha's ideas about his teachings about the karmic process differ from some others, especially the ones that think that everything causes, you know, that every aspect of your existence and existence as a whole is a product of karma. He said, you know, not so much. I don't believe so. He said, instead, the only reason that I'm offering these teachings, and again, you know, I'm not here tonight to tell you what karma is and what karma is not. More in the spirit of the Buddha himself, you know, when he would preface his teachings, especially in one famous instance, don't just take this as gospel because I told it to you. Abide contemplating the possibility that this is so. Okay. So as with any of us, when we explore a subject like this, for me it's been a matter of consulting some of the ancient texts, both the words the historical Buddha is thought to have said, ancient commentaries, contemporary commentaries, teachers of mine whose teachings I have found useful, the essential kind of pragmatism of the approach that the Buddha took. He said, the reason I speak of karma is to help you liberate yourself from your suffering. Okay. Especially from the self-generated suffering. Okay. So among the theories of karmic theories he did not subscribe to, but one that's nonetheless quite popular today is sort of what you might call cosmic comeuppance. You know, sort of like a theory of justice, you know, what goes around comes around. Okay. There's an African proverb that says, he who defecates in the trail shall meet flies on his return. You know, it's this notion that you're going to get yours, by God, you know, even if not in this lifetime, you're going to spend a few lifetimes as a dung beetle. See how you think about that. So it's not some universal theory of justice, but rather this simple observation on the Buddha's part that the fuel of intention determines the nature of the fire. Okay. So he said, you can build different kinds of fires for different purposes. You can build an intensely hot fire for smelting ore. Okay. You can build a smaller but nonetheless intense fire for the purposes of cooking. You can build a different kind of fire for the purpose of keeping warm. And that each of those kinds of fire is best served by different kinds of fuels. Okay. That if you use toxic fuels, you're gonna get a toxic fire. Okay. My dad was a pharmacology professor at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And one of the things he did in the course of his research was to find a cure for oleander poisoning. Oleanders, if you eat 3 oleander leaves, you will die of a fatal heart attack. Very poisonous. And they're very bitter, so happily most people don't eat them. But there were poisonings that would occur in southern Arizona and deaths that would occur of people raking up the leaves in their yards and burning the pile of leaves. And they would breathe the smoke and keel over and die, okay, because of the toxins in the oleander leaves. Okay. So it matters what you build your fire from. The fuel of intention determines the nature of the fire that will be sustained. So, in the West, the notion of karma also kind of falls victim to the free will versus determinism debate that's extant in Western, dialectic Western philosophical realms, you know, that turned to, and it was also very true in the Buddha's time, you know, in the theistic tradition that he was born to, you know. Is the entire universe this vast, you know, kind of clockwork mechanism, and everything is predetermined in terms of, you know, the caste you're born to, the nature of your body, and and everything else that happens to you in your life is always predetermined, and so basically just following the social rules is all that's left you to do, versus the notion of free will. You know, it's one that was really wrestled with in the Old Testament and the New Testament alike in the Christian tradition. That kind of hits a brick wall when you get to Buddha Dharma, because it raises this question of who is enslaved in a deterministic universe, or who is actually free to choose. And the Buddha was of the view that that's not such a helpful way to think about the situation. Okay. Because it presupposes a who. So this contemplation of karma is very closely related to this idea of whether or not there's a self, whether or not there's a who to experience a deterministic universe, or a who to exercise free will or not. When the various leaders of the various philosophical schools of thought in the Buddha's time would come to him and challenge him and say, well, is there a self or not? You know, is there a self that experiences a continuous rebirth based upon the karma they generate in this life and that determines the life they'll lead the next time around? Or is there nothing? Do you just die and that's the end of it? Okay. Is there a soul or not? Is there a self or not? You know, and so those who would challenge him in that dialectic, you know, philosophical combat way, he would basically sit in silence, and then they would get bored because they were trying to pick a fight with him and they couldn't, so they'd leave. Okay. And then somebody would ask him, well, that was no fun. You know, I wanted to see you go a few rounds with these people and show them, you know, that, you know, where you're coming from and why. And he said, well, I didn't answer their questions because I could tell from the questions they were asking they would never be able to hear my answer. And what he said is this. He said the self cannot be said to exist, nor can the self be said to not exist. The self exists when the mind creates it, and the self does not exist when the mind is not creating it. Now you see it. Now you don't.
Can you say that again, please?
Yes.
It's my selfish rebellion.
Yes, of course. You know, yeah. The deflector shields on the Starship Ego don't much care for this one. The self may not be said to exist, and it may not, nor may, okay. The Buddha said the self may not be said to exist, nor may it be said to not exist. The reason is because it exists when the mind creates it and does not exist when the mind is not creating it. Masterpiece theater exists when you turn on your TV, okay? And at least for you, it does not exist when you turn the TV off, right? Or change channels. So the self is a mind-created entity. Except, of course, it's not a thing. It's a mind-generated process. In the process of generating the self, we also generate the karma attached to the actions of self. The Buddha said, don't care much about all the theories of karma. I equate karma with intentionality. I equate karma with the intentionality that precedes speech, action, and way of life. There are many different translations of the Dhammapada, which is the collection of the Buddha's more poetic teachings. Okay, you know, kind of Buddha's greatest hits, you know, in poetic form. The first section of the Dhammapada is called Twin Verses. And the more literal translation of the Twin Verses, first phrase in the first stanzas of the first section of the Dhammapada is, mind is the precursor of all things. Meaning that how we experience ourselves, how we experience others, arises first in the mind. The Eswaran translation of the Dhammapada, it's a more liberal rendering that says, we become what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we create the world. From the, you know, the spoke on the Dharma wheel of what's called right thought, okay? Also translated as right or wise or beneficial intention. So the rendering that I gave when, at the end of our sitting this evening, we become what we intend to become. All that we are arises with our intentions. With our intentions, we create the world. Speak or act with unwholesome intention, and sorrow will follow you as surely as the wheels on the cart follow the oxen who draw it. We become what we intend to become. All we are arises with our intentions. With our intentions, we create the world. Speak or act with wholesome intention, and happiness will follow you as your shadow, unswerving. Okay. At the beginning of one of the introductory series on foundations of mindfulness that we have every October, I'm a Sangha member, someone who was to become a Sangha member later on, said, oh, if we become what we think, I'm doomed. Reflecting on what she had been thinking during the sit, right? But that's where the freedom lies, okay? The thing that's so wonderful about mindfulness meditation, the reasons that it's so powerful, is that what happens as a result of growing mindfulness is that we start awakening more and more fully to the content of our thoughts, to the content of our own past karma as it influences our current state of mind. And the more awakened we become to what those influences are, the more clearly we're able to see them, the less likely it is that we're going to act on them in an unwholesome way. Okay, so that's the freedom point. Okay. The reason all this is so important in terms of a, you know, coming to a useful or constructive or beneficial understanding of karma is that in terms of your own self-image, if you're firmly convinced that you don't have any choices to make and that you're simply a victim of the circumstances of your conditioning, then indeed you have no choice. You don't have any choice because you think you don't. You've convinced yourself you don't. But if you have some faith in the healing ability of the mind-body process and the making, and that the making of healing choices is possible, then you do. Ask anyone who's ever been in a 12-step program. Okay. If you think you're a slave to your conditioning, you are. If you have even some grain of faith in the possibility that choices are available to you, that you can awaken to your conditioning, that you can start to see more and more clearly what the consequences of your past actions are, then just as a result of the piquancy of that, as a result of being able to gain a deeper level of understanding of what the consequences of past actions were and how they've caused you suffering in the present, it makes it that much less likely that you're going to do something in the future that's going to cause some more harm. That's a big wad. Let's talk about it for a couple of minutes. Please, thoughts, reflections, questions, anything I've touched on so far? Yes, please. You're on.
The we're doomed part. I remember reading years and years ago this book by Isabel Allende called House of Spirits.
Yes.
And and it led me to believe that I was really going to like this series of books, because they go to Mass at this big cathedral in Santiago, and the priest is giving this fire and brimstone message about who's going to hell, and her protagonist, this little girl, and her sister are sitting there listening, and her sister's this beautiful green-haired girl, mm-hmm. right? And so the protagonist looks at her sister and says, "Gee, I guess we're fucked, huh?" And so the family picks all the kids up and rushes out of church, totally mortified.
Uh-huh.
That's it. That's all I
have. Okay. Thank you for that. Let's go down the Christian path for a minute here. Reinhold Niebuhr is the one who is to whom this prayer is most directly attributed, and his last rendition of it, usually referred to as the Serenity Prayer, in 1951, was this: "God, give me grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed, the courage to change the things which should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other. Give me grace to accept with serenity the things that cannot be changed, the courage to change the things which should be changed, and the wisdom to distinguish the one from the other." So it's a very interesting kind of parallel teaching to this notion of awakening to one's karma, in terms of what might be changed, what possibly may not. So there are certain things, what we call immutable characteristics, you know, about how we came to be in this life, you know, our height and our body shape and our skin color and, you know, the color of our eyes and things like that. And we sometimes spend an awful lot of money trying to change these things or modify them in some way or another. But there are some things that just have to do with the way things are. You know, when the Buddha talked about karma, again, he talked about intentionality. He said that there are other things that are aspects of who you are or aspects of how the world is that are basically just a function of cosmic roulette. didn't really use that simile, but that's what he was kind of getting at, you know, roll of the dice or whatever. It's just the way things turned out. Okay. Many years ago, my wife Abby and I were involved with others in the San Francisco Bay Area forming an organization called the Shanti Project. And the Shanti Project's purpose was to provide counseling and companionship for people who were facing life-threatening illness and their families. As part of our training, we'd have lectures and discussions by oncologists who would come in and talk about, because most of our clients, you know, had some kind of cancer or other, usually stage 4. And so they would talk about oncogenesis, you know, where cancer comes from. And back at the time, there was still a lot of wondering about whether there was some mysterious pathogen. It was this kind of linear, you know, cause-effect situation. In very rare instances, it did in fact turn out to be the case, as with AIDS. But mostly not so much. Okay. Instead of talking about A causing B, okay, mostly what they talked about instead is something they would call a causal matrix. Okay. And the three contributing elements to the causal matrix that they would talk about, one was genetic predisposition, especially cancers of certain organs. Okay. Second was environment, environmental circumstances. An awful lot of cancers seem to be environmentally triggered. The third is personal behavior.
What was the third?
The third is personal behavior. Okay. And so all those forces converge, okay, to arise in cancer either beginning or not beginning to happen. Okay. So some of those, you know, some aspects of that causal matrix are what are called immutable characteristics. Okay. It's just what particular gene is hanging out on what particular chromosome, and at some point in your life it's going to turn on, and you're off to the races. So there's that. And then there's all of the volitional choices that were made by everybody in society that has gone to constitute the health or lack thereof of the environment we live in. And then there's how we deal with the environment we got born into and our conditioning. So, and we, none of us really knows for sure how strong a role any of these is going to play. It's different for each one of us. But you can kind of parse out a little bit in Niebuhr's prayer, you know, some of those distinctions. The wrinkle here from the standpoint of Buddha Dharma is this. The existential question from the Buddha's point of view is how to discern what cannot be changed. Because ceaseless change is one of the cornerstones of the Buddha's teaching. Anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Anicca means ceaseless change. And in other words, change is the only constant. Change is happening all the time. There's nothing that cannot be changed because everything is always changing. Okay, nothing stays the same. Okay. The question is whether change can be encouraged in a direction that you would find to be beneficial. And this is whether it's your own behavior or whether it's social change as well. Okay. So discerning what characteristics are immutable, okay, and which ones, you know, we're experiencing climate change right now at a very rapid rate. And it's having certain effects on the planet. Bigger and more intense and more destructive storms, bigger and more intense and more destructive wildfires. This is simply how the environment works. You inject more than a certain amount of heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere, and this is the outcome. Okay. And the argument right now is whether this is immutable or whether this is susceptible to change. Okay, and that's part of the kind of the big debate right now. And the debate even among scientists, you know, there's not much doubt that it's going on and that fossil fuel combustion is probably the single most important contributor. Whether or not radical reduction in fossil fuel combustion can prevent the worst excesses from global warming from happening is something that remains an open question right now. When Abby and I were visiting the Grand Canyon last month, the field ecologist there, you know, it's mostly pinyon juniper trees and so these great grand ponderosas growing on the south rim, lovely lush environment. And they said, well, chances are 100 years none of these trees are going to be here. They won't be able to survive. A lot of them are dying of thirst now. Okay, and the ones that don't die of thirst, they think are probably going to be taken out by fire. And so to avoid that outcome, there would have to be some pretty major changes undertaken on the part of the human population right now. So this is where it gets very interesting from the standpoint of Buddha Dharma. Okay. Is this something that cannot be changed or something that can be? You know, it's something that, for which we don't know the answer. And here also is where the Buddha said it's so important to pay attention to how you are relating to the unknowable. Because if you decide, whoops, nothing can be done, you know, might as well just kick it in, live it up, you know, have a good time right now, because the future is going to, you know, be hell on earth, period. Or, on the other hand, if you believe that it's possible that by a concerted awakening of views and a concerted coming together of discourse, of collaboration, of reflection, that in fact it might be possible to effect a major change in human behavior in a relatively short period of time, we might in fact be able to avert that outcome. It's something that's not knowable. But what the outcome is in fact going to be depends a lot on what we think it's going to be, you know, on the extent to which we are or are not willing to invest ourselves in a particular outcome occurring. Okay. It's way up there on the global scale, the atmospheric scale. Okay. Same is true of ourselves individually. In order for something to happen, you have to believe that it's possible, insofar as personal change is concerned. And so that's where the awakening to the karma that we have inherited becomes so important. Please.
This hearing of the Buddha Dharma and his thoughts on us creating our reality I feel it's always wonderful when we see the overlaps from different thoughts. And I don't know, it's easy, I believe, for us to believe that Eastern thought and Western thought are so different, but we see how many ways they overlap. And just the simple Western philosophy thought that I think, therefore I am, is the same.
Well, it is, depending on where you put the emphasis in the sentence.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think, therefore I am, or I think, therefore I am. Right? And that's, you know, the latter is exactly what the Buddha was saying. The mind is the precursor of all things, including the construction of self. Remember in, you know, Glenn touched on three of the five daily recollections. I am of a nature to age. I have not gotten beyond aging. I am subject to illness and infirmity. I have not gotten beyond illness and infirmity. I am of a nature to die. I have not gotten beyond death. Okay. Fourth one is all that is mine, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. The fifth one is I am born of my actions. In other words, I am born of my karma. My actions are the womb from which I have sprung. It's another way of we become what we think, right? And how we speak and act and live our lives as a result of that. Okay. I am born of my karma. I am heir to my karma. My actions are the womb from which I have sprung. My actions are my relations. My actions are my protection. Interesting, isn't it? My actions are my relations, my actions are my protection. So how I interact, how how I touch others in the world, how others touch me, happens through a web of karmic relations. My actions are my relations. My actions are my protection. Basically, what he's saying there is that if we speak, act, live lives with wholesome intention, then we are protected from the generation of future negative karma. And we are more likely to be treated beneficially by others as well. Not necessarily, but more likely to. Increases the likelihood. My actions are my relations, my actions are my protection. All of my actions, both wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful, of these I will become the heir. All of my actions, both wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful, of these I will become the heir. Okay. So the function of the five daily recollections is to haul out of the closet and dust off and shine a light on these things that the ego just doesn't really want to look at, right? It's just saying, but the effect of doing that is very liberating, because it helps wake us up to the consequences of our actions. Yes, please.
Can you talk about that in the light of Jungian psychology and bringing your shadow material to consciousness? Is it a similar process? I don't know. What more to say about that?
Right. Not being a Jungian scholar, I can't say, but, you know, I do know that Carl Jung said, you know, that the true liberation of the mind occurs not through envisioning realms of light, but in basically investigation of the darkness,
right.
Inquiry into the darkness. The latter way, he said, however, is difficult and therefore not popular. But that's the way of Buddha Dharma. It's casting light on that which the self prefers to keep in the shadows.
The reason I asked Boyd is the true self is really important in Jungian psychology and Jungian psychology and Christianity as interpreted by John Sanford,
mm-hmm.
Episcopal priest and others. He talks about the true self.
Yes.
The person you were created to be by God. Our work is to cut away, just get out of our own way and find that true self.
Yes.
Whereas Buddhism seems to say, ain't none.
we're mired in language here. And Jack Kornfield's book, The Path with Heart, he's got a chapter titled No Self or True Self.
Oh.
And the thing where, you know, there's some kind of cultural bone-on-bone friction that happens between the classic original understandings of 12-step programs. Bill Wilson, you know, he was trying to be as ecumenical as he could, you know, higher power, whatever you envision that to be. But it's still, you know, got a pretty strong atheistic flavor to it, you know. Jack says that in his view, and he's, you know, he's a psychotherapist, that the no-self, anatta, not-self, understanding in Buddha Dharma and the true self that's spoken of otherwise are not really that different. Okay.
Good.
The reason in Buddha Dharma that we don't speak in terms of a permanent and abiding self is because it's something that's clung to. Okay. Something the mind glomps onto. Oh, there's my true self. That's the self that's going to go be with God when I die, or that's the self that's going to get reborn, you know, on and on and on. And we're saying that,
as opposed to our master persona.
Or they're all selves are a fabrication.
Right.
Okay. And that what we're doing, and so, you know, as we continue to burn off whatever karma we've got in the past, is that we're substitution by opposite. When we're seeing the arising of the current effects of past unwholesome decisions, right? And we're kind of detoxifying them, like that bacteria that eats, you know, petroleum, right? It's basically detoxifying a poisoned environment. And so that's kind of what we're doing with mindfulness. We're awakening to the kind of the toxic effects of some of our past karma with the effect of not generating it in the future. So again, it's kind of, it's largely a matter of language. I think the underlying intention is very, I guess what I would, maybe a translation that I would offer, you know, the Thai forest meditation master Ajahn Chah used to talk about the one who knows. You know, another way of understanding that is, it was tricky because he didn't want to get people understanding that there's a, that there's somebody in there who knows, but rather, I think probably a skillful way to understand is what one might call spiritual intuition. You know, and I think the true self could be equated with what one might call spiritual intention. And that's a naturally arising intelligence that's in the mind that is able to come forth when these sort of obscurations of constructed self are laid to one side. Yes?
So, just when I thought I had to figure it out. We're sitting. We send in a question. We're engaged in Vipassana. What I've heard the Quakers refer to as the small, still voice within.
Yes.
Is that the authentic self that you're referring to from Ajahn Chah?
Yes.
It's like, shoot, now I've got this self again, even if it's my authentic self.
Okay. Maybe a way to think about it biologically might be the body's immune system. Okay. So, for instance, when the Dalai Lama talks about joy being our spiritual birthright, okay, and the Buddha talking about the Dharma as a healing lineament, as a healing element, okay, in the psyche, what we're talking about is the mind-body process, is the spirit, if you will, you know, the innate capability of our mind to heal itself from the suffering that we generate. So the self may be generating the suffering. The mind also has the capability of bringing the self to an end. The Buddha said, basically, I discovered that that capacity lies within each one of us. Okay. That compassion is there waiting to be cultivated, that it is an innate tendency of mind, okay, just as there are other innate tendencies of mind. And so what we turn our attention to doing is cultivating those innate beneficial tendencies. And we cultivate them until such time as they really kind of outweigh the more unwholesome ones that, you know, are part of whatever hand you got dealt. Okay. Until at some point we get to the point where we're not generating any more karma at all, either positive or negative. Okay. Because there are no unwholesome intentions that arise in the first place. The way that happens, however, is by continuing to awaken to the unseen and unexamined and unacknowledged, in some cases unknown, energies in the psyche that cause us to, you know, think unwholesome thoughts, say and do unwholesome things. Joseph Goldstein talked, when he first started really exploring the Dharma, he was doing some trekking in India, and this is like close to 40 years ago now, and they were meeting up at some hut for this multi-day trek, a hut-to-hut trek. And there was certain equipment that they were supposed to bring and whatnot for on the trail, and everything else was going to be provided. And in each of these huts, there was supposed to be enough bedding to keep everybody warm at night. It's really cold in the Himalayas. And so he gets up to this hut in time for supper, and then they all go to bed. They go into the little dorm area, and there's cots set up for everyone. Each bed has two blankets on it. Okay. So he goes to bed, starts to go to sleep, and he's really cold. And so there's several people that haven't arrived yet for the night. And so he goes over to one of the empty cots and he gets another blanket and puts it on and he goes to sleep. Much later on in the night, the people who are arriving late for the trek come in and they go to their cots. And one of them finds that he's only got one blanket and it's even colder than it was before. And he hears this person say, "Hello? Has anybody got my other blanket?" And he lies there in silence. And he lay there in silence all night long. Didn't get too much more sleep. And not because he was too cold. He tells that story 40 years later. And the reason he tells it is because the decision that he made on that evening had ramifications that would carry forth through the rest of his life. Okay. And so there was this period of self-recrimination and whatnot. And then at some point, you know, later on, as his understanding of the Dharma became deeper, then he understood the nature of greed, the nature of generosity, and the nature of, well, you know, sacrificing somebody else's comfort for his own. And the motives that had led him to do that. So it provided insight into how his mind was working at the time that has ever since that time informed him and the way he's behaved going forward. There's a really famous book written, I think, in 1947 by Thomas Merton, or 48 maybe, called The Seven Story Mountain. And it's about how he went from, being a, you know, kind of member of the New York literary class to a Trappist monk. And he tells this story, and this is one of the kinds of karma that's talked about. There's the instant karma that happens when you do or it's skillful or unskillful thing, and there's an immediate reaction. There's the karma of memory, okay? And that's what we're talking about now. He tells this story about his childhood and growing up. He had a very unhappy childhood. Both of his parents died when he and his younger brother were both children. And they lived a troubled life during their growing up. He said one of the things that he remembered, and his brother had kind of a troubled relationship as well. And he said that when he was growing up, when he was of a certain age, maybe around junior high school age, something like that, sixth grade, seventh grade, and he had some friends that he liked to hang out with. His little brother always wanted to tag along, and he had no use for his little brother, and neither did any of the other people in his circle of friends. And so when his circle of friends would go sort of into their clubhouse or something and his little brother tried to tag along, they'd throw rocks at him, yell at him, tell him to go away. And what his little brother would do instead is he'd still tag along, but he'd stay just outside of rock throwing distance. Okay. Later on, he and his brother, as they reached adulthood, he and his brother became very close. And they had a really warm bonding relationship, and they loved each other very much. And his brother joined the Army Air Corps and became a B-29 pilot, flying heavy bombers or heavy bomber pilot over Europe, was shot down and killed. And Merton talks about, you know, in terms of his own dark night of the soul, you know, the suffering that he endured and having a close look at all the things he'd done in his life. He said the one that continued to be a searing knife to the heart was the memory of his little brother just outside of rock throwing range. And his state of mind at the time that caused him to create that kind of separation. Right? And he said one of the breakthroughs toward his finding the grace that made it possible to become a monk was instead of the self-excoriation and the dark thoughts, the really painful, piercing memories he would have, was being able to forgive himself for who he was at that point in time. So this setting of intention, reflecting on the past karma, setting the intention not to do it again. And that intention has to do with even the most minor things. You know, where I should stop and get milk on the way home from the market, or is that, you know, kind of slightly blinky cord I've got in there going to get me through? Or more major decisions, so what should I do with the rest of my life, you know? Should I quit this job? Should I go look for another kind of job? Should I get into this relationship? Should I get out of this relationship? Okay. These big questions are really worthy of reflecting on intention as well. Gil talks about, you know, reflecting on the deepest intention. So it's worth really asking yourself sometime, you know, what's the deepest intention for my life? And a yogi told him one time, the answer was a negative statement, such as the absence of something. Person said, I would like to live without fear. It's a noble intention. But he said also it's worthy of reflection and in some cases a little bit of translation. Why do you want to be free of fear? Okay. Turn it around and make a positive statement and you can take it one step further. If I can live without fear, it means that I can connect in a deep and loving way with other people. So that is my intention. To have deep, loving connection with other people. This is actually a whole different intention than saying that you want to live without fear. Let's take just a moment and sit together. We become what we intend to become. All that we are arises with our intentions. With our intentions, we create the world. Speak or act with unwholesome intention, and sorrow will follow you as surely as the wheels on the cart follow the oxen who draw it. We become what we intend to become. All that we are arises with our intentions. Speak or act with beneficial intention, and happiness will follow you as your shadow, unswerving. Good week.